I want to read together, if I may, from John chapter 6. And I'm just reading from verse 15 to verse 21. Therefore, when Jesus perceived that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he departed alone to a mountain by himself. And when evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into the boat, and went over the sea towards Capernaum. And it was now dark, and Jesus had not come to them. Then the sea arose because a great wind was blowing. So when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea and drawing near the boat, and they were afraid. But he said to them, "It is I, be not afraid." Then they willingly received him into the boat, and immediately the boat was at the land where they were going. And we trust that God will bless the reading of his truth. There's something attractive about the prosperity gospel theory. It says if you follow Jesus, then all in the garden will be rosy. You will have good health, material wealth, and great prospects. They say the closer you are to Jesus, the better will be your circumstances. The closer you are to Jesus, the richer you will get. The closer you are to Jesus, the healthier you will be. The problem with that theory is it's not true. It's not true. History proves it's not true. You don't need to read too much into the history of the church to read about the sufferings of godly men and women in the past. The Bible proves it's not true. We have catalogues of the sufferings of men like the Apostle Paul. We have records of the sufferings of the early Christians. Jesus himself didn't have much material wealth. He had to ask on one occasion for a penny. He said, "The foxes have holes, the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." Experience proves it's not true. Because we who are believers know that we pass through some dark experiences, even when we're trying to follow Jesus to the best of our ability. Even when we are being faithful as we know how to be, things go wrong. Our health fails. Problems and difficulties and crises arise. I was going through a crisis like that at the end of June in Peru. And during that time, I read those verses from John chapter 6. And then I turned to Mark's Gospel chapter 6 and I read the same story about the storm that the disciples went through and Jesus coming to them in the storm. And then I read it in Matthew 14, the same story. And Jesus spoke to me through it, taught me some lessons that I needed to learn. You see, Trevor and Christine Morrow were following Jesus to the best of their ability. They had left home. They'd gone to Peru to serve the Lord. They were busy in the gospel. They were being faithful as they could be. And Trevor took ill. And he was in hospital, hoping to come back home again here to get seen to whenever we were coming back later on at the end of July. But on Friday night, the 20th of June, I got a phone call. And I was in Tacna, which is about 2 hours' drive from where Trevor was. And it was 10:30 at night. And I just got a phone call from Christine saying, "Derek, I need you. I need you now." And I hopped into the car and we drove like mad across the desert. And when we got there, Trevor was in hospital and the doctor said, "Look, I have to operate. And if I don't do it now, he's going to die. And if I do it, we haven't the facilities here to cope with intensive care. It was just a small hospital. We don't have what's needed." But there's only one thing to do: operate. And so he went into the operating theater, and Christine and I sat and we prayed and we cried and we prayed and we cried. And about 3 o'clock in the morning, this woman came, who was a next door neighbor, and she came up and she just said, "Christine, I thought you were on your own and I just came to be with you." She wasn't a Christian. And at 5 o'clock in the morning, the surgeon came out and he said, "Right, the operation's over. He's still alive. And I need to close him up, but I need blood. You go and get some." He told me what his blood group was, and it's one of the rarest groups. Only 3% of the population in Northern Ireland have the same blood group. Where do you go to get blood at 5 o'clock in the morning in a town like you? We thought about it. We prayed. We asked people around. There were security men outside. They got on the radio. "Can anybody have this type of blood?" "No, nobody has that type of blood." We thought about the army barracks. "Well, there's plenty of soldiers there. We'll try that." We went, we tried that, and the commandant wasn't available, so we couldn't get in there. And suddenly this wee woman says, "I'm away." And away she went. And she got outside and she found a taxi man and she got him to get on the radio around all the taxi men in Elo, looking for people with this type of blood. And we thought it was over. But then at 7 o'clock in the morning, this wee woman came back and she had 7 people with her. And he was able to get the blood. They had found it. But next day, things got worse. And an infection set in. And when that infection set in, the doctor said, "Look, there's nothing we can do. We can't do it here." And in the meantime, I was talking to Billy on the phone and we were in touch with a company that does repatriation. And I will never forget it. By this time, you folk here at home were praying. You were meeting with special prayer meetings and praying. And I remember getting a phone call from the company in London and a doctor in London on the one side and this doctor from the Peruvian guy who had done the operation on the other, and I was on the phone and doing interpreter between the two of them. And the doctor in London says, "Can you get him to describe what his colon was like when he removed it? What it was like when he removed it? What was it like?" And he said it was como mas amor, and I interpreted that for him. And she said, oh, it's gangrenous. He's going to die. You've got to get him out of there. And Billy got on the phone with them and arranged. And you have no idea the way the Lord answered your prayers. No idea. To try to arrange an air ambulance in Peru when you're in Peru is impossible. To do it from London is doubly impossible. But it was done. And I'll never forget then on Sunday morning, and that was afternoon here, and Sunday morning and evening, and this little plane was coming in, and Ilo is by the coast, and there's just a strip along the sand. And that's all. There's no radar. There's nothing. There's just a strip along the sand. And because it's by the coast, sometimes the fog comes in. And the fog came in. Could it get any worse? And I could hear this plane up there. And I thought, he's never going to come down. But he did come down. And he got down, and Trevor was put onto the plane. And I remember standing with my arm around Christine, and we were standing watching the plane as it took off, and we both said goodbye. We both thought, that's the end. Next time we see him, he'll be in heaven. But you were praying here at home. At that very time, I know that this church was praying. God answered prayer. And he survived the journey. The next day we went down to Lima and to the clinic where he was. And next thing I know, when I went through the door, this wee woman was at my heels. And she says, I need blood. And I christened her the vampire, because every time I came into the hospital, she was saying, I need blood. I said, what do you mean you need blood? She says, well, here's the way it works. If he needs 10 pints of blood, and I give him 10 pints of blood, you have to give me 10 pints and make it up. Either you or his family. I said, well, you can have many you want. But when she discovered what age it was and what tablets it was on, she didn't want it. And she couldn't get Christine's, because Christine is MS. She wouldn't take hers. And this went on for 2 or 3 days. And at last I went to the director and said, look, can you do something about this? And he said, well, will you buy the blood? I said, well, buy anything to get the vampire out of my hair. And eventually then the blood was got. And things began to move up. And then eventually he got home. And when he got home, the Royal thought, wow, it's all over. It's great. And then in the Royal, he took a pulmonary thrombosis. And things went downhill again. But people prayed. God answered prayer. And I want you to know that. If we were Pentecostals, we'd be shouting, amen. Hallelujah. God answers prayer. And I want to thank you for your prayers. But I want to come back to the passage that I read together. And just underline 3 very simple things that we can learn from. First of all, in this story, the disciples were obeying Jesus. They were doing what Jesus asked them to do. In fact, in both Matthew and Mark's record, it says that he constrained them to get into the boat. He made them get into the boat. The idea is that they didn't really want to go, but he made them get in the boat. They were doing exactly what Jesus wanted them to do. He wanted them to get into the boat and to head to the other side. It was evening. It was nearly dark. It would have made more sense to wait for the morning light rather than go alone. They could have waited for Jesus and they could all go together, but they didn't. Jesus constrained them to go, and they were obeying Jesus to the letter. And that's important. It's important to understand that for all of us in this new year, we need to follow Jesus. We need to do all that's within our power to obey his commands in our life, in the life of the church. Very simply, the disciples were obeying Jesus. But secondly, the disciples came into a storm. And you see, it's important for us to understand that obeying Jesus doesn't mean that there'd be no storms. Obeying Jesus doesn't mean that things won't get black. The storm was fierce. Matthew's record tells us that the ship was tossed with the waves. Matthew, Mark, and John all make mention of the force of the wind. They all refer to the blackness of the night, to the darkness. Can you imagine what it was like? The wind was blowing. The boat was bouncing. The waves were getting bigger. The night was becoming blacker. The feeling of despair was getting deeper. And there is a stark, chilling reality in the little phrase in John 6:17 where it says, Jesus had not yet come to them. They were without Jesus in the boat. They must have felt forsaken. They must have felt he doesn't care. And this was not a momentary thing. Matthew tells us in Matthew 14 and 25 that it went on until the fourth watch of the night. That was about 9 long, black, dark, stormy hours. That was 9 hours when it was getting worse by the minute. And what do you do when you're in the storm? What do you do when it's black and it's wet and it's scary and you feel forsaken? What do you do? What did they do? This is a lesson Jesus taught me in Peru through this word. You keep on rowing. Very simple, isn't it? But that's what John 6:19 tells us. That they, and the tense is, they kept on rowing. They kept on rowing. 9 long hours, 4 long miles. And it wasn't easy. Mark 6:48 tells us that they were toiling, they were struggling. In fact, the word that Mark uses there, it means that they were tormented. They were tormented. They were at their wits' end. It was no easy thing to keep on rowing in the storm. But that's what they did. You keep on rowing. You keep on doing what you can do. It's as simple as that. That's what you do in the storm. Keep on doing what you can do. Keep on going. Keep on rowing. They kept on rowing and they cried out. Mark tells us that when Jesus was coming, He would have passed by them. It was as if he was going to pass them by, as if he was drawing them to call out to them. They thought they had seen a spirit. But you know, God has ordained it, that in the time of trouble, he says, call upon me. Call out to me. What do you do in the storm? You keep on rowing. And you keep on crying. Keep on calling out to God. Because that's the way God has ordained that it should be. I don't know where you are in your life right now, but maybe there's somebody here and you're going through it, and it's tough, and you don't know what to do. Let me tell you, the only advice I can give you is, look, keep on rowing. Keep on doing what you can do, and keep on calling out to God. Keep on crying out to him. And the third thing about this story is this, that Jesus came when it was his time. How many times they must have thought, where is Jesus? Why doesn't he come and fix it? How many times have you been like that? Why doesn't Jesus fix it? Will he ever come to us in this storm? Will this trouble ever end? Where was Jesus? Well, Matthew and Mark both tell us in Matthew 14:23 and in Mark 6:46 that he was praying on the mountainside when he saw them struggling in the boat. Where is Jesus when we're in the storms? Well, we do know that he's praying for us. Hebrews 7:24 and 25 tells us that because Jesus lives forever, he will never stop serving as a high priest, that he's able to save those who come to God through him, because he ever lives to make intercession for us. We have a great high priest who is always praying for us, always interceding for us in the storms as well as in the calm. Jesus made himself known to them when the time was right. And we have difficulty with that. I had difficulty with that. The problem is, why does God wait until the sickness has lingered? Why does God wait until the money has gone? Why does God wait sometimes until the other side of the grave? None of us knows the answer to that. But we do know that Luke 18 and 7 is true, where it says that God will always give what is right to his people who cry to him night and day. Of course, the other thing we must say is, we're far better off than these disciples were. We're far better off. Because whether we are aware of it or not, Jesus is not only praying for us, he is always with us. He is always with us. He will never leave us, no matter how fierce the storm, no matter how dark the night, no matter how tough the rowing. He has said, I will never, ever, ever leave you. I will never, ever, ever forsake you. And that's a tremendous blessing as we move into a new year to know that he's always going to be with us, no matter what comes, no matter what goes. It's interesting that Matthew records the incident of Peter getting out of the boat almost as an appendix to the story. But it also teaches us that when we take our eyes off him and we begin to sink and cry out, he reaches out his hand, he lifts us up. Whatever life throws at us as believers throughout this year, we know this. We have Jesus with us all of the way, all of the time, in the darkness, in the storms, in the night. And there's a lovely ending to this story. Matthew 14 and 33 says this: those who were in the boat came and worshipped him. At the end of the storm, it all ended in worship. In worship at the feet of Jesus. And they bowed before him and they said, truly, you are the Son of God. Mark tells us they were full of amazement. They were full of wonder. They worshipped at his feet. Whenever the storms of life are over, that's what we'll all do. All of the storms that we go through at the end of the day, it will end in worship. Worship at his feet. I trust that somehow what the Lord taught me through the crisis last summer will be a help to some of you here. And I want to encourage you to keep on praying. Trevor Morrow just got word this week. He's going back to Peru in February. God's wonderful. He answers prayer. Keep on praying. Amen.